Welcome to the Adventure Podcast and this specialist series, Explore How to Plan an Expedition, a series created for the Royal Geographical Society. I'm Matt Pycroft, an expedition specialist filmmaker and photographer, and I've been going on expeditions under various banners for 15 years. I also sit on the council of the RGS. Episode 12 focuses on communicating scientific discoveries. In this episode, I speak with Dr. Heidi Silvestre about why science needs communicators, what science communication can look like, how to select your audience, and ideas for teaming up with other specialist communicators. We also talk about the importance of understanding your own science in order to communicate your findings effectively. Finally, if you're looking for support with planning your own expedition or field research project, then head to rgs.org to begin the journey. Right, let's get started with episode 12 of How to Plan an Expedition. Please, can you begin by introducing yourself? Tell me who you are and what you do.
Hi, everyone. My name is Heidi Silvestre. I'm a glaciologist. So what I get to do is to study ice around the world to better understand how this ice is reacting to climate change. And most importantly, my job today is also to communicate our scientific results to the wider community, whether it's governments, companies, the general public. There is a big urgency to make sure our science gets across and our messages get understood.
And before we get into that, just to give us some context, could you please give me like a brief overview of your expedition experience?
A brief overview of my expedition experience. Well, I've been really fortunate in my career to start doing expeditions very, very early on. You know, I'm from the French Alps, so I guess I got a label of, okay, this girl can go anywhere, she'll survive. So when I was a master's student, I got the chance to start quite big with an expedition in the Himalayas, an expedition in Greenland. And that really got me started with really kind of hardcore glaciology fieldwork. Since then, I've been spending extensive time in the Arctic, especially in Svalbard on the Svalbard archipelago, about 1,000 kilometers away from the North Pole. Spending some time also in Antarctica, working on the Antarctic Peninsula, the Larsen C ice shelf. And lately I've been working on glaciers, but those that are close to the equator. So they're called tropical glaciers, which is quite far off from my comfort zone, my typical comfort zone, but still ice, but this time quite high up in elevation. And before you get to the ice, you have to cross some jungles. So it's a little bit different. It makes life very exciting.
Sounds amazing. So my first question for you in this episode, which I think you're going to laugh at because you have a lot to say, is why does science need communicators? Why can science not just be done for the sake of science?
You know, science is really good at communicating science to scientists. So we do a lot of communication, but first and foremost, for the scientific community, for academia. And this is important because it helps academia, it helps science to get better, to get a better understanding of things, to make progress. But my job, you know, is to study ice, and ice all around the world is disappearing, is melting extremely rapidly. And this is having a terrible impact on human beings around the world, whether you live close to the ice or really far away from it. So today, yes, it is important to make sure that scientists share their findings with the scientific community. But we need to go beyond that. We are desperate to make sure that the general public, that companies, governments, understand the urgency of climate change, because it is truly the survival of humanity that is at stake. So today, you know, if we want people to make an effort, if we want people to decarbonize their activities, people need to understand why. Why do they need to change? Why do we need to fundamentally, deeply transform our societies today? And if you don't understand that climate change is happening, if you don't understand what the loss of biodiversity means, why would you make a change? And those who hold this wealth of knowledge, those are the scientists. So truly, it is I believe, our duty or responsibility to make sure that we share our messages in order to propel people into action.
And what does science communication look like? Is this just the publishing of reports on Twitter so that we can read?
Yeah, you know, it always makes me laugh when I see a scientist sharing a link on Twitter and they look at my great study without explaining anything. And you're like, oh, please, come on, like, do a slightly better job at explaining why should people care? Today, we really have no excuses because, as you said, science communication can be on social media. This is such an amazing way to reach out to especially the younger generations. And when I see scientists on TikTok, you know, on Snapchat, on, of course, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, this works. This is definitely reaching beyond the converted, beyond those who will definitely read your study no matter what. But science communication can also be, you know, reaching out to government, reaching out to your, you know, the elected people in your region, your representatives. It could be communicating science to your former school. It could be communicating science to your friends, to your family. It comes in all shapes and sizes. And I really, really try today to encourage scientists to do more science communication. And it's very easy to get started, you know, contact your local newspaper, your local radio station, use your own social media channels, and try to engage, try to make people care, whether it's through the passion that you have for your own topic, whether it's because you get to, perhaps you're lucky and you get to travel to faraway places that are really exotic and look incredibly beautiful, whether it's because people should care because what you're studying will impact their lives in the future. You know, you should really try your hardest today to make people care. It is your duty, truly.
That's interesting. And I will go there now. So is it enough with the world as it is at present to just do the research, collect the data, analyze findings, come up with a conclusion? Or, you know, you're saying it's a duty. Do you think that scientists are obligated to be communicators in and of themselves? Do you think that every research grant should be given based on, you know, having a, not being very eloquent, should all grant applications have an element of outreach and legacy attached to them, as well as just the science?
Yes, yes and yes, absolutely. I think it should be compulsory and it is becoming compulsory. So now every time you apply for a grant, whether it's for a big or a small project, you have to have an outreach part associated with your project. Then it's really up to you to do the outreach your way. Most research projects will open a web page, a website that will never be updated, that people will never find. I think it's important that, you know, this outreach part of your project should be proactive. You should be the one, you know, reaching out to your local city council, to the local companies in your territory, or to the schools where you live. You have to be proactive. People really don't really care about tropical glaciers when I speak to them about tropical glaciers. Now, everybody should care about them. It is your job to make them understand why they're so important, why we all depend upon the meltwater from these glaciers, for example. So I believe that it is our duty to communicate our research findings, you know, bearing in mind that when you're a researcher, time is of the essence. So we're already totally overstretched between applying for grants, between teaching, doing the research, analyzing the results, publishing them. But it's also down to the funding bodies and to the universities, the research labs where you work, to give you maybe, let's say, half a day every week to do outreach. And it's a win-win situation for everyone, because if you're able to promote the science that you do, promote your research institutions, not only you look good, your research institution looks good, and people start to care and will follow the research even more and will want to maybe to act upon this, to make a difference. So it is truly a win-win situation. And I think the urgency of climate change calls for this type of global action from the scientific community.
Yeah, and we've talked in previous episodes in this series about teams and kind of leadership and creating teams and working with teams. And we've spoken a lot about how you don't need to be everything. You know, it's okay to be a specialist and make sure you've got the team around you. Do you think there's a version of this, and I recognize my bias given my career choice, to actually bring in when appropriate or when money allows, although I should say that lots of filmmakers and photographers will work for free on interesting projects. Do you think bringing the pros in is a good idea when it comes to communication?
100%. You know, when I was starting my career in academia, I never had any training to do science communication. Nobody told me how to do it. And I made loads of mistakes, and it took a lot of time to try to get it right. And it's not until I started to meet with journalists, you know, who would try to give me some tips, that I started to understand how things actually worked. And again, you know, when people get into academia, they usually don't get in academia because they love the spotlight, you know? We usually get into academia because most of us are totally introverted. We just like to be, you know, in our office or in the field doing our own research, being able to focus on one thing and one thing only. And so I totally understand, you know, I was like this before, that when you're doing research, you want to do research and that's it. But why not then teaming up with people who love to do that? Whether it's, you know, video makers, filmmakers like you, people who do, I don't know, radio shows, or who are amazing influencers on social media. I think this is very powerful to team up with people who will also, you know, expand your reach. At the moment in my country, in France, there is a big movement to try to get the influencers of Instagram interested in climate topics. Imagine the amount of people we can reach when working with them. So I totally agree. And of course, you know, I think we both agree on that. That's we have to team up. We have to be a lot more efficient. In the end, all that matters is how can you make sure that your message has the right impact. And one thing I'm convinced of is that it is not, in the end, numbers, statistics, that will actually convince people that they have to make a change. It's all about the storytelling. It's all about the emotions. This is what truly works. And it took me years to understand this. And I only understood this because I was working with people like you.
Well, that's good, because I agree. You saw my fist bump as you said it. I mean, there's a cheesy line, which is just what you said, which is, and I use it in almost every client conversation I ever have, which is, humans are motivated by stories, not data. Now, there are obviously exceptions to that rule. But I think the way that we communicate is key, and who we communicate to. And it's something I'd like to talk to you about that you've touched on. But it's, you know, how we communicate. I've been part of so many projects, or brought in at the early stages of projects, where someone has said, one of our aims is to make a film. And the analogy I often use is, well, let's change that to paint a picture. Now, what are you going to do with your artwork once it's finished? Are you going to hang it on the wall of your bedroom? Are you going to put it in a museum or a private gallery? Now, let's say you do put it in a museum. How are you going to tell people it exists? Yeah. How do they know to go to the museum? You know, why would they go when they can go anywhere else? And I think one thing I'm really keen to talk about in this particular episode is, you know, communication is more than just making a thing, writing a thing. It's actually, how do you get that in front of the right people? And one thing I wanted to ask you about is, you know, audience selection. When we think about our audience, are we just, you know, the answer everyone gives is, well, everyone, and that's not an acceptable answer. What sort of versions of audience are there, and how would you tailor a piece of communication based on, you know, trying to appeal to every teenager in France, or trying to appeal just to Macron to make a decision?
Oh, wow, that's such a good question, because I think this is what obsesses me every day. Audiences and which buttons you can press to make them react. Because this is what we need today. We don't want them to passively you know, receive the information. We want them to not only understand the information, understand it enough that they are motivated to act. And I think that transition is very important because, and sorry, I'm making a bit of a tangent here, but in science, in academia, what we do is we put the science out there. You know, there is the IPCC reports, there is, I don't know, the State of Cryosphere report. There are publications coming out every day. But it is the transition from understanding why the information is important to action that is crucial today. And in order to get this transition to work, then we need to identify the right audiences and we need to know how to communicate to these different audiences. So what I try to do at the moment is try to think about, okay, which people can have the biggest impact? Obviously, yes, in science at the moment, we need to speak to governments. There is no doubt about this. I think it is probably the hardest type of audiences, you know, we can speak to, because they're definitely motivated that things that are, let's say, bigger than themselves, probably not in the right way. Maybe the next election, maybe, you know, the economy, the survival of their own political party, their popularity. This is what they truly, truly care about in the end. But then, you know, when we speak to governments, they often tell us, well, you should speak to the general public because they are the ones that are supposedly influencing us. So then we try to communicate to the general public and they are definitely motivated by other things. You know, they care a lot more about their health, for example, the health of their own families. Of course, they care deeply about their economy because, you know, you need to have a roof above your head and to be able to, you know, feed your own family before you should care about the climate, truly. But it's very important that, you know, we provide them with the right type of information that they can also make the right decision to elect the right people. So, you know, the two are tightly connected. And last but not least, you know, I think it's very important to beyond the general public and, of course, youth and the older generations, we need to speak to the private sector as well. And in academia, I think we have kind of forgotten about the private sector for a very long time. So when you look at, you know, what the IPCC does, what academia does, it's mostly communicating to governments. But actually, where you have a lot of leverage, where things can change very quickly, are, you know, with companies. And companies are starting to understand that, you know, they cannot just continue the way they are working right now. They're really struggling to recruit the right people if they're only motivated by profits, by revenue. They need to change their values. They need to change the way they operate. And eventually, you know, fighting climate is going to be a constraint. You know, they will have to do it. It's not going to be a matter of wanting. It's going to be a matter of, okay, if we don't do it, we're going to be receiving crazy fines and we're not going to be able to continue the way we are operating right now. So to me right now, there are these three big, you know, really broad, as you can see, audiences. There is, you know, elected individuals, there is the general public, and there are the companies. But in the end, Matt, when you look at these three types of audiences, they're all human beings. They're all human beings. And what we should never forget is that when it comes to emotions, when it comes to thinking about future generations, these are the buttons we can press every single time to make them react. And I can see that this is truly what works. What will your legacy be? You know, I often tell them that future generations will judge us based on the decisions we make today. You know, did you decide, did you just, you know, sit down and accept it the way things were? Or did you try your very hardest to make a change? And this really, when I speak this way to people, I can definitely see that basically you start touching their hearts. And this is the biggest button that we all have. This is the emotions are this, you know, universal language that works every single time.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. So when you're, I assume you work with lots of young people and kind of early stage career academics and scientists. When you're talking to them about communication and outreach, and that element of a project, what are you encouraging them to do? And could you give examples of the type of thing that they're doing that works?
Yeah.
Because just to add as well, I think it's potentially dangerous for us to sit here and say, you know, you should make a film that is going to directly target government, because whilst we absolutely should, and that's the sort of thing that you and I are focused on right now, we're a bit further into our career than probably lots of people who are planning their first expedition.
Yeah, you know, first of all, of course, I truly encourage them to get started, you know, in any ways they can, just try to do a little bit of outreach. And I often recommend them to go and speak to the communications officer at their universities and start working with them, because they really need allies. They need scientists who like to communicate. They need scientists who have the energy and the time to do so. So truly, your comms office at the university is your biggest ally to start doing outreach. And you know, I was very lucky because I did my PhD at the university in Svalbard. That's how it got started. You know, every week in Svalbard, you get a prime minister, you get ministers, you get a king or a queen. Like, it's totally wild up there. Or journalists. And you get so many opportunities just to try to get started by giving maybe a short talk to these journalists. I would often also recommend them to use what if they feel comfortable with. That's very important. We don't all feel comfortable to be, you know, filming ourselves, you know, doing field work when you have better things to do. So if you like to write, write. You know, if you like to do audio podcasts, of course, just do that. If you like to film you, then do that. If you like to take pictures, do that. No matter what you like, you can find one thing that will work for you. But the most important thing is to learn by doing. You know, there's no secret, but, you know, if you want to become good at doing outreach, you have to constantly try, maybe fail, but try and try and try again. And use, again, what you feel comfortable with and just, you know, stick to it. And eventually you will get more and more opportunities to do so. And that's what's so great about outreach, is that you will start to share what you love the most, share your passion with other people. Other people will start to care. They might start asking you for interviews, start, like we're doing today, to record a podcast. And eventually, you know, one opportunity will lead to another that will lead to another. And when you're trying to become a scientist in 2023, this is such a huge plus on your CV, you know, for a team, for a university, for a research lab, to know that when they hire you, they also hire someone who can represent them very well and someone who can have an impact. So this is definitely something that looks amazing on your CV if you're motivated to do so.
Yeah, I completely agree. And, you know, as you well know, I'm not an academic and have no training in that space, but I think it's potentially also an interesting method of, tell me if this is, you know, just inaccurate, but of making sure you really understand what it is you found and simplifying the data, you know, breaking it down into, well, here's a single graphic or here's five images. The thing that sticks with me is the blue and red temperature graph, right? Everybody knows what I'm talking about. Everybody's seen it. I do not understand it intellectually. Mm. You know, I don't know the data. I don't really understand what it means, but I know that it's really bad and it means we need to stop doing all of the naughty things. And so my long-winded point is that that single image, the one that you were wearing on your hat when I saw you in Greenland, that's an ad campaign.
Mm, for sure.
Now, I don't know if that's what the team that made it intended for it to be, but it is an ad campaign.
Totally.
It's reaching out, you know, so many different audiences. Of course, you see it. It's called the Climate Stripes. And it was put together by Ed Hawkins and his team. I think it's such an amazing way to communicate. And you see it everywhere now, truly, because it's visual. You know, you don't need a PhD to understand what it means. You know that red doesn't mean it's good at all. When you look at, you know, you can go on showyourstripes.com. I think that's the website. I hope I get it right. But you can look at your city, at your country. You can look at the Arctic Ocean and you quickly understand, you know, what it means. And I think this is, you know, the beauty in that really simple way to represent science is that it's down to the absolute essentials of what the science is supposed to mean. And you know, you're right when you said that doing outreach is all about making sure you, first of all, understand your own science to boil it down to what's really important to people. And you know, I've been doing a lot of teaching in the past few years, and let me tell you, the students, they see it in your eyes if you don't know what you're talking about. And it's the same when it comes to outreach. If you're not able to explain something that is, yes, very complex in simple terms, I mean, then there's no point in doing that. You really need to make sure that you boil it down to what's essential. But most importantly, you need to understand what will work for these people. So you need to think about, okay, where are they coming from? What is their daily life like? You know, what will they understand this? Will they rather understand that? What do they care the most about? Is it, you know, their energy bills at the end of the month? Is it, you know, the fact that they won't be able to use their cars? You really need to put yourself in their shoes in order to share an important message. And, you know, for the past 3 months, I've been doing talks pretty much every day all across my country of France. And I've been meeting with, yes, big companies, but also really small organizations, tiny schools in super rural areas. And it's been fascinating to me, you know, as a scientist, to understand where these people are coming from, what matters to them. And, you know, day in, day out, this has made my message so much stronger every time, to make sure I understand how we, the scientists, can basically bring the right information to these people. Because again, we are paid by taxpayers' money. And it is our duty to make sure that we prepare them for what's to come.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I'm conscious of not overwhelming people with this. And I think you're doing an amazing job of explaining why it matters so much. And I'm kind of making this up on the spot, but I wonder if, you know, any kind of early stage academic is interested in planning their own or first expedition and is thinking, oh God, I've got to think about the outreach, but that's not what I'm interested in even. I think just be honest about that. You know, I want to be the scientist. I want to do the science. Well, at the same university, there are almost certainly film programs, marketing programs, politics, economics programs. And, you know, in the real world of work, people like you team up with people like me. And I don't know how often this happens, but I'd encourage people to go find an aspirant filmmaker, find aspirant communicator. They'll ask all the right questions like, you know, what does the first 90 seconds of a film need to look like in 2023 when people are offered, you know, 1,000 different things to watch every hour on the internet? You don't need to know that. You don't need to understand it. You need to know somebody who does.
You know, and I think this is such a genius idea, and we're so much stronger together. And we also have to be honest, Matt. I mean, it pains me to say this, but no matter what we do right now in academia, doesn't work. We have to be honest about this. It doesn't work. We're 30 years in IPCC reports. 30 years. We've known since the 70s that, you know, the more fossil fuels we burn, the more climate will become chaotic. And, you know, we've been publishing this whole time. We've been publishing reports the whole time, and it still hasn't hit the mark. So we need to think outside of the box today. And that's why we need to team up with people who know how to do this, people who are pros at this. And right now, you know, in France, we have this movement called to put more climate, more biodiversity in culture, because it needs to be sprinkled into everything right now. Of course, into fictions, into documentaries. It needs to be sprinkled into poetry, into adverts. We need to see this everywhere. It needs to dominate the media landscape that people have access to every day. We cannot do this alone. So yeah, guys, team up with the pros for sure.
Yeah. Now, I don't want to take us on too much of a tangent, but I think that's one of the interesting things about science communication that is often overlooked is it is happening all the time. And actually, some of the most amazing methods of I would say even like climate change and social change communication is happening through fiction. So, I mean, just let me pick an example at random out of a hat, like Blade Runner. You know, it's the perfect example of a dystopian future where AI has taken over, the robots are, you know, taking over, and there are scenes where they find one plant and they're shocked that it's growing leaves and it's in the wild because everything else is dead. And, you know, it's not a climate change film, but I'd imagine probably a minority of the audience are thinking, oh, I really don't want that world to exist in the future. We should probably make sure it doesn't. And I know it's a curveball and it's a tangent, but what I'm trying to evidence is it doesn't have to be simple and boring.
No.
You know, there's a whole creative world out there of ways to communicate. And as we're saying, you know, you can team up with people to do that or come up with it yourself. Creativity is a lot of fun.
Exactly. And you know, we're so proud to study what we study. We truly want the world to care, you know, whether you study tardigrades stuck in Antarctic ice, for example. We want to share this with the world. And so the best way to do this is to work with people who would know how to touch people, how to really make them care. And, you know, the other day I was rewatching probably for the 20th time Interstellar, which is not, you know, right off the bat, it's not a movie about climate change, but it's definitely a movie that makes you care about the planet. And you understand that, okay, we have a planet that works pretty well. We should really care about it. And when you see how many people have watched Interstellar around the world, it's absolutely giant. So this is why, you know, we really need scientists to be there as well. So when you start receiving, you know, requests the other way around, from journalists, from filmmakers, from poets, from painters, I get those every day, Matt. Well, I know that this can have a way bigger impact than I can have myself. So try to help them out. And it's a team effort in the end, because all we want is to make people care. We want people to understand, and we want people to act. And academics alone will never manage to do this on their own. Yeah.
Yeah. So what do you think are the main barriers? I think we've discussed a lot of them, but, you know, as we start to draw this conversation to a close, what do you think are the main barriers for emerging expeditioners and academics when it comes to communication?
You know, there are many. I think to me, the first big barrier is the fact that in academia, most of us have short-term contracts. And you don't want to be, you know, the tall poppy. How do we call this, you know, in Australia or in New Zealand? You know, you don't want to stick your neck out. You don't want to make waves. Usually when you're in academia, you know, your position is so fragile, you usually have a contract for a year or two or three, and you want to make sure that, you know, you leave your position with, you know, good marks and that you haven't annoyed anyone. And doing science communication looks a bit, still a bit dangerous at the moment, because you have to stick your neck out, because you have to become kind of a public persona, and you will face public criticisms. You know, I'm getting hundreds of messages every day from climate skeptics, for example, that some of them are pretty insulting. And so I think this is a huge barrier in academia. And so this is why it has to be a team effort. We need to make sure that if someone from a university, from a research team, wants to do science communication, we need to help them out. And we need to assure them that we will be backing them in case something happens. You know, we have their back. We will be making sure that no matter what, we will be supporting them. And this will not endanger the position that they have today. And I think, yeah, the second thing, and I've already alluded to this, but the fact that you will become, yeah, a public personality, and that you will, of course, you will not make everybody happy. You know, we're talking about things that are quite harsh for people to understand, you know, that people have to reduce their carbon footprints, that people have to maybe use their cars less. And some people are getting really angry about this. It comes with a position. If you want to do outreach, you have to be prepared for the fact that the most vocal people on social media are usually people who don't agree with you and might be attacking you directly. But, you know, in the end, what you need is a strong support system. You need to make sure that you have a good team around you that will support you no matter what. You need, again, to team up with people who will teach you how to communicate the right way. And you need always to remember why. Why do I want to communicate today? What is your end goal? And that's very important because I'm getting quite a few messages from other academics telling me, oh, you didn't explain this very well on the radio the other day. Hang on, I had 5 minutes to explain why Arctic sea ice is important if you live in France, for example. So I tried my best. In the end, and that's my own, you know, limit, I want people to care because I know that if Arctic sea ice disappears, it will impact my entire country and it will create more extreme weather events. I don't want people to understand how sophisticated our computer models are. I absolutely do not care about explaining to people how sophisticated, how complex my science is. In the end, I want people to care because it will impact their daily lives. And so that's very important to always remind yourself why you want to communicate. Because in the end, why I communicate is all about trying to, and I'm saying this in a very humble way. It doesn't sound very humble, but in the end, it's about human lives. You know, it's trying to prepare populations for the worst impacts of climate change. And if your reason to communicate is to make sure you people understand how sophisticated your science is, why not? But you really need to have a strong target, a strong motivation to communicate because it's not simple every day, but you need to always remember why you're doing this.
Totally. And I think that you've just made made a lot of really important points, but one that I'd like to develop a little bit is bringing it back to humanity. It can be disappointing for some people, but it's often the best or only way to appeal to a mass audience who haven't changed their mind. I mean, looking at the subject of rewilding, you know, George Monbiot, like him or not, because he's a controversial figure, says that any rewilding has to be done for the benefit of humanity. Now, that's because we won't do it if we don't do it like that. I mean, if your passion is Amazonian beetles and you really aren't that interested in human beings, well, that's okay. That's fine. It's great that you love Amazonian beetles, but the reality is you need to make it matter. You know, why do Amazonian beetles matter to humanity? And that might be because the environment they live in is the rainforest, and without the rainforest, we don't have any oxygen. But it's finding a method of bringing it back to why we should care. Otherwise, there will be no change.
And you know, why do we need people to care about Amazonian beetles? In the end, it's because we will need each and every single one of us to fight whatever is happening right now. You know, we don't have the luxury to ignore a portion of our populations. We don't have the luxury to say, oh, I'm only targeting this, I'm only targeting that. Of course, we can divide and conquer, absolutely. But right now, we really need everyone to care because if we aren't already, we will all be affected by climate change, by the loss of biodiversity, and we all have the power to make a change. So this is why we need to connect with them. And whether it's about beetles or glaciers, no matter what works, we need to communicate.
Yeah. And again, I think, you know, you've touched on something there where it's just about being part of the movement. And that I think that's true of academia and it's true of communication. You know, I would struggle to imagine a world where most early stage academics or early career academics are trying to solve everything whilst at university. You know, they're building on the shoulders of giants. They're adding to the pool that exists already. It's exactly the same for communication. You don't need to be making, what was the Leonardo DiCaprio film called? Don't Look Up.
Before the Flood. Oh, Don't Look Up. Yeah, sure.
Those things are perfect examples. You don't need to make either of those films whilst, you know, working on your first expedition outreach project. It's more just thinking, what can I add that hasn't been done before? And, you know, what can I add to the conversation? That's, I would personally say, is a really good way to start with this. Because we obsess over, I'm going to do an expedition first, whether that's because, you know, a brave, strong man wants to plant a flag somewhere, or whether that's because nobody's explored a specific area before or doesn't understand this about a tropical glacier. But it's exactly the same for communications. Please don't make the same film again. Don't write the same book again. You know, do something different. Add to the pool.
And also, I must say, you know, we've been talking a lot about expeditions, obviously. But it's not all about that. You know, of course, it's super sexy and very easy to communicate when you're, when I'm in Svalbard, for example, or going to Antarctica. It's super obvious. Everything looks incredible. You know that people are going to be attracted by your content. You know, they're going to be interested in watching. But also, you know, sharing your daily life at work, whether you're, you know, on your computer all day, every day, looking at satellite images, looking at data that has already been collected. This is already pretty amazing. And, you know, you don't have to study something that is really remote and extraordinary to make people care. It's truly your passion that will shine through and that will make people care. It could be because you're studying a river, you know, in the middle of the UK that everybody knows. Well, actually, I'm sure that what you're looking at, that people don't already know about this. So it doesn't have to be extraordinary. It doesn't have to be, you know, going to space. It doesn't have to be that extraordinary to make people care. Even if it looks really mundane, perhaps to you, believe me, it is not for 99.9% of the population.
That's totally true. I mean, I could come up with a dozen examples of this from a comms perspective, but I'll do two quick anecdotally. One amazing film I saw was 100 seconds long, and every second was a percent, and it was how land in Britain is used. So, you know, 18, and it was all drone shots shot from the top down. So 80, he's walking through the middle of the frame. So 18 seconds, each is a different field, a shot a second, but 18 seconds or whatever it is fields, 22 seconds is forest, half of which is native, half of which is pine for wood. You know, 2 seconds is river, 2 seconds is lake, 8 seconds is city. And just as a method, just watch for 100 seconds only, you know, shy of 2 minutes, just going, huh, that's Britain. And then another quick example is, with all the amazing films made all over the world, the film that won grand prize at the biggest nature documentary festival in the UK last year was about bees, and it was made in someone's garden in Bristol.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah, amazing example.
Yeah, we don't need to travel the world. Well, it's a recurring theme throughout this series, actually, is of course we all want to go and do amazing things in interesting places. It's a great thing to do. And if I can't speak for everyone who's listening, but I'd imagine if you're listening to this, you are interested in traveling to far-flung places. But the reality is there is a lot of adventure, exploration, expedition opportunity, and science to be done, probably within 10 miles of your house and definitely within 100.
For sure, yeah. And the sky is the limit. And there are no excuses today. We all have the tools in our hands to communicate and the people around us to help us to do that and to have an impact. So yeah, let's roll up our sleeves and get started.
Is there anything you think you should have talked about that you haven't?
You know, I often question the role of scientists when it comes to doing outreach. And of course, I'm convinced it's important. But, you know, over the past few months in Norway, which is a country I know very well, loads of things have happened. You know, in January, the government opened 92 new leases for oil and gas. A week ago, they are opening new, I think 12 new leases for oil and gas, investing something like 20 billions into the oil and gas industry. And then I tried to see how academia in Norway was responding to this. I didn't see anything. And what I saw was just total, utter silence. And I'm convinced that most academics in Norway, if not all, are thinking that this is an absolute disaster, not just for Norway itself, but for the whole of humanity. And so I think the best way to respond to such announcements is to work together. We don't want one or two scientists suddenly marching over Oslo and try to have an impact on the government. What we truly need is the entirety of academia in those countries to team up. Let's say, I mean, let's be crazy, Matt. Take a day off, maybe, and travel to Oslo to meet with the government. What is a day off when you think about the crisis that is happening today?
Do you think that the reason the big academic institutions weren't publicly outraged is because they're funded in part by the government and they don't want to upset ministers? I don't know.
No, absolutely. It is truly the case. And, you know, in Norway, I guess we're very lucky to have academia that is so well funded because the funding comes from these funds that are directly or indirectly connected to oil and gas. Of course, I totally understand why it's so difficult in this country for scientists to express, you know, their opinions, to share their knowledge in a way that will be understood by the government. But today we really need to think long and hard about our duty as scientists. You know, we've been talking about outreach. Outreach is great. It's very nice. You know, we're trying to have an impact. But this is even bigger. It's trying to convince the government to stop, you know, their activities in oil and gas that have contributed to making Norway one of the richest countries in the world. But today we know that we cannot have more exploitation of oil and gas in 2023, because this will otherwise impact generations to come. So, you know, I absolutely don't blame the scientific community in Norway for reacting or perhaps being a little bit quiet when it comes to these announcements. But I would really try to encourage my friends, my colleagues in these countries to team up, work together. Imagine if, you know, the entire university in Svalbard, which is the fastest warming place on Earth today, would suddenly decide to go on strike to make the government understand that, you know, if they continue to do this, Svalbard as we know it will disappear. I mean, the planet as we know it will disappear. And so I really think that, yes, we need to do outreach. We need to connect with as many people as we can. But, you know, it's even bigger than this sometimes. It's about transforming our societies as a whole. And as academics, we are the ones holding the knowledge. And, you know, as Spider-Man said, I think, or the uncle of Spider-Man said, with great power comes great responsibility. And we have the power of knowledge. So we have the responsibility to make a change when we see a government making such crazy decisions in 2023.
Amazing. You just quoted Spider-Man in a podcast, Heidi.
You know, I always show this in my lectures when I do lectures on outreach. This works with the younger scientists.
Totally true.
Let's see what people say. But yeah, I think this is important.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. And I'm sure, you know, I'll just say something. I think I'd, you know, off the back of that, I'd encourage people to be willing to be kind of roguish and rebellious with their communication. Be disruptive. It's very rare that anything sedentary will make it through the content filters. And outside of noisy clickbait, what makes people listen is roguish rebellion and being honest. And essentially, I would argue that most scientific communicators that are successful at the moment are activists. I think that's an important distinction to make. So I'm not saying, you know, don't be naughty, play by the rules, but be rebellious and be brave.
I love that. Yeah, I totally agree with you. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
I think people see through it now. And when they see that you're putting your heart on the line, your career on the line, people will definitely listen to you.
Yeah, for sure.
Ace, we'll end it there.
Ah, that was super interesting. Thank you, Matt.
No, thank you. Thanks for listening. For more information on how to get started with planning your own expedition or field research project, head to rgs.org. This podcast is hosted by Matt Pycroft, produced and edited by Laura Jaycock for Terra Incognita Publishing, and Shane Windsor and Laura Melville for the Royal Geographical Society.